I'm delighted to introduce our debate on the future of the civil jury. The American civil jury has all but disappeared. Cases are rarely heard by juries, which may be a good thing. Juries are expensive, time-consuming, and unpredictable. On the other hand, they are also a constitutional right, and there may be much value to keeping this right, notwithstanding the costs. We are looking forward to a lively discussion on this question. Moderating this clash of perspectives is Judge David Porter of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Porter was nominated by President Donald Trump and confirmed on October 11th, 2018. Before his appointment, he was a shareholder at Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney, where he practiced commercial and civil litigation. Judge Porter received his bachelor's degree from Grove City College, his JD from the George Mason University School of Law. He clerked for Judge D. Brooks Smith on the United States District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania. Judge Porter.
So the original Constitution guaranteed jury trials in criminal cases, but was silent about civil cases. And that wasn't an accident. The framers were unanimous in their high regard for jury trials, but not necessarily in civil cases. In Federalist 83, Hamilton observed that proponents and opponents of the proposed Constitution all agreed that the trial by jury is a valuable safeguard to liberty, and indeed the very palladium of free government. But then a few sentences later, he wrote, "I cannot readily discern the inseparable connection between the existence of liberty and the trial by jury in civil cases." And then he went on to explain why the guarantee in civil cases was omitted from the Constitution. But the anti-federalists were unmoved. And in fact, it might not be an overstatement to say, and some have argued, that the entire Bill of Rights was adopted because of the anti-federalists' demand for a specific guarantee of jury trial in civil cases. One could fill a book with quotes of prominent figures lauding the jury trial. In fact, about 25 years ago, the American Jury Trial Foundation published such a book. In fact, they filled two volumes, nothing but quotes, lauding the jury trial system. I assume that you're familiar with such praise for the jury trial, but I'll share just a couple of examples, and maybe some of you can try to guess who said these things. First, in suits at common law, trial by jury is as essential to secure the liberty of the people as any one of the pre-existent rights of nature. Any guesses? Madison. And here's the other one. I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution. Jefferson. And yet, as most trial lawyers know, jury trials today are few and far between. Here's some data from the Western District of Pennsylvania, the United States District Court in the Western District. That's where my chambers are in Pittsburgh. Over the last 5 years, a little over 2,600 civil cases were filed per year in the Western District. And during those 5 years, here are the number of cases that ended up being tried to civil juries. 16, 20, 17, 25, and last year, 18. In other words, 0.7% of the civil cases filed during that period ended up being tried before a jury. And I suspect the Western District is representative of all the other districts around the country. Based on the boxes that parties check on the civil cover sheet when they commence an action, the top five categories of the few civil cases that are being tried to juries in the Western District are employment disputes, civil rights cases, prisoner conditions cases, contract disputes, and personal injury product liability cases. Aside from the fact that fewer lawyers have fewer opportunities to develop their courtroom skills, is this a positive state of affairs? Or is it an alarming one that bodes ill for the Republic? Our panelists will try to answer that question, and as with the original Federalist, Anti-Federalist debates, you may come away from this discussion finding some merit in both positions. Renee Leto-Lerner is a professor at the George Washington University Law School, where she specializes in U.S. and English legal history, civil and criminal procedure, and comparative law. She writes extensively about the history of American juries and is working on a book, two books actually, about the American civil jury from the colonial period to the present. She clerked for Justice Kennedy during the 1996-97 term. You might remember that Professor Philip Hamburger from Columbia was supposed to be here on this panel. Unfortunately, there was a death of someone close to his family just a couple of days ago, and so he had to bow out. And so we're really grateful that Shane Inspector's here to replace him. Shane is a founding partner of Klein Inspector here in Philadelphia. He's obtained scores of jury verdicts, including 16 verdicts of 8 or 9 figures in cases involving MedMal, product liability, medical devices, premises liability, and so on. He's also an adjunct professor at his alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And again, we're really thankful that you stepped in just yesterday morning, stepped in to fill the gap. So we'll start with Renee.
Thank you for that introduction, and I'd like to add my thanks to Shannon Spector for stepping in so quickly and with such expertise on the subject, so I'm looking forward to this very much. And I'd like to pick up on Judge Porter's discussion about numbers. So Judge Porter gave you some numbers from Western Pennsylvania, and I'd like to give some numbers from state courts and also from the federal courts generally. First, because I am a legal historian, a teeny bit of history. In the year 1938, when the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were enacted, the rate of trial for civil actions was 20%. And that figure had been steady from the late 19th century. So what you see is a steady rate of about 20% from the late 19th century into the 20th century. But then, the year 1938 was indeed a watershed. With the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the game changed. And trial rates started to plummet. And they have continued to plummet to this day. So just to give you some statistics, in 1962, in federal courts, of cases that went to disposition, there were bench trials in 6% of cases and jury trials in 5.5% of cases. That's 1962. In 2010, bench trials as a percent of total dispositions, 0.34%. Jury trials as a percentage of total dispositions, 0.73%. So there has been dramatic decline now that the federal rules are in place. In state courts, we see even lower numbers of jury trials. The number, again, of cases going to disposition, civil cases in state court, jury trials are less than 0.1% of the total. So indeed, we have the case of the disappearing jury. And a question is, why is that? And many academics treat this as a very deep mystery. Well, I thought I might ask people who know best, that is, lawyers. Why do you settle cases rather than going to jury trial? And maybe Mr. Shannon can shed some light on this as well. But what lawyers tell me is that now that we have discovery, extensive discovery because of the federal rules, we know pretty much the facts. And you don't need to hold a trial to go through all the facts again. In the past, you actually needed to hold a trial to figure out what happened. Not anymore. Now we're in the world of depositions and interrogatories and document discovery and electronic discovery and all of that. So it's a different world now. In addition to that, they tell me, there is the unpredictability and expense of jury trial. And the part of it that they emphasize is the unpredictability. Question, of course, is compared to what? So some studies have been done comparing what a jury would do with what a judge would do. And these studies date from the 60s and have continued to some extent into the present. Generally speaking, those studies find that in terms of questions of liability, the judge and the jury agree about 70% of the time. About 70% of the time. And supporters of juries say, well, look at that. They agree most of the time. Yeah, that's true. But there is a substantial number of cases, 30%, in which they don't. So nearly a third of cases in which they don't. But the major difference between judges and juries is not on questions of liability. The major question is on questions of damages. The amount of damages that a jury gives in many cases as opposed to a judge are very different. And you have here in this city, this month, an example. I'm sure you are all familiar with a case against Johnson & Johnson in which a jury brought in a verdict of $8 billion, about 10% of Johnson & Johnson's annual revenue, because of an antipsychotic drug. And there was a question about whether Johnson & Johnson had adequately labeled the drug or warned of its side effects. It had, in fact, Johnson & Johnson had labeled the drug according to FDA requirements, saying that breast enlargement, the subject of the case, could happen with this drug. And yet, a jury awarded $8 billion. When I mention this to folks who aren't lawyers, they sort of say, well, why not $6 billion? Why not $11 billion? It's just other people's money, right? And you all are familiar with the Roundup verdicts, of course, that are occurring around the country and especially in California. One of the most interesting things I was told about damages awarded by a jury was told to me by a plaintiff's lawyer in Des Moines, Iowa. And the lawyer said that he was representing the plaintiff in a medical malpractice case where there were relatively minor injuries and he didn't expect to get a very significant award. The jury came back with an award of $681,000, which astonished him. He was not expecting to get anywhere near that amount. He found out later that what had happened during deliberations was the jury had decided on liability late one day, and they said, you know what, let's go ahead and break and come back the next morning and talk about damages. So the jury did that. That night, a juror had a dream that the damages should be $681,000. And the jury reassembled the next morning. The foreman said, well, does anyone have any idea what we should do about damages in this case? And the juror said, I've had a dream. I've had a dream that the verdict should be $681,000. And the foreman said, do any of the others of you have an idea what to do in this case? They said, no. So that was the verdict. I call it the dream verdict. Juries can also make mistakes in the opposite direction. They can be too stingy. In the area where I'm from, Northern Virginia, jurors tend to undercompensate plaintiffs in auto accident cases. I was recently involved in an auto accident case. I was recently a plaintiff in an auto accident case. And the lawyer that I consulted in the case told me, you know what, it's too bad that if this thing goes to trial, which it won't, it'll settle, it's too bad that it would have to go to a jury. And I said, why? And he said, because you would get more from a judge than you would from a Northern Virginia jury. So in other words, juries can overcompensate and they can undercompensate, and they rarely agree with what a judge would do. So it's a difficulty with damages. There are questions about competence in complicated cases, particularly, for example, patent cases. Judges will almost always, in public, speak well of juries, as Judge Porter's quotes suggest. In private, it can be a different matter. I have had a federal circuit judge tell me that holding a jury trial in a patent case is, quote, crazy. I have had a U.S. District Court judge of long experience who had presided over many jury trials in patent cases tell me that, he used a slightly different word, he said it was insane. That is what judges will say in private. Those of you who have handled patent cases, I'm sure you understand this is often involving very complicated technology, and even cases that aren't patent cases, all sorts of complicated commercial transactions that can occur that are difficult for ordinary juries to understand. And on top of that, lawyers are eager to shape the jury in ways that favor their clients. A friend of mine, in fact, my law school roommate, now litigates patent cases, generally speaking, on behalf of plaintiffs, patent infringement cases. And she says, she's very open about it. She tells me, I try to strike from the jury anyone who might know what's going on. Anyone with an advanced degree or who otherwise shows signs of intelligence, I try to strike from the jury, because that gives me an advantage in presenting my case for the plaintiff. And she says, the defense lawyer is trying to do the opposite. The defense lawyer wants the most educated jury possible in a patent infringement case, because that's a difficult argument to make. So, another problem with juries is that you cannot get a full appeal, not the way you would with a judicial decision. So when a trial judge holds a bench trial and makes a judgment, gives an award, the judge has to explain it, has to write an opinion explaining that, and then that is subject to a reasonable level of appeal. It's not quite the level that you would get, by the way, in non-common law systems. In non-common law systems, the level of appeal that you get is the standard of review is de novo fact and law. In other words, there is no deference paid to the decision below. We don't quite have that, but we do have, I think it's fair to say, serious review of judicial decisions. But jury cases are different. It's very hard to know why a jury decided what it did, and it's very hard to review that verdict. Yes, generally speaking, the large verdicts are cut down, but not to the level that they would be if a judge were awarding them. So that is another issue. So of course, what normally happens in litigation is not trial at all, but settlement. But what's wrong with settlement? Settlements often are not based on the merits of the case. They are done in the shadow of the jury, trying to guess what a jury might do, for one thing. And they also depend heavily on the risk aversion of a party. Then, of course, the cost of litigation is factoring into that settlement very heavily. And so as a result, very often the settlement does not primarily reflect the merits of the case, but rather those other factors. And the lack of fee shifting in this country means that it opens the door for strike suits, right? People who will bring suits in order to get settlements based on litigation costs, just making the thing go away, even if the underlying dispute is without merit. So that is our legal system today. What's the solution? I'm actually going to concentrate on adjudication, and I'm going to concentrate on adjudication in the courts, with the understanding that there are other things going on, primarily arbitration. But I'm going to set that aside for a second. We're stuck with the Seventh Amendment, unfortunately. And yes, even though Madison spoke well of it on the floor of the Congress, which is what Judge Porter was quoting, he argued vigorously against a right to civil jury trial in the federal Constitution during the Virginia ratifying convention. He was going head-to-head with Patrick Henry. So maybe we have sort of a reprise of that today. But in any event, Patrick Henry was saying he wanted civil jury right in the federal Constitution to help debtors. In other words, to nullify debts. This horrified Madison. Madison was like, how can we possibly have any economic development in our new nation if juries are going around nullifying debts? We've got to take care of creditors, and yes, even if creditors are out of state, and yes, even if creditors are foreign. We've got to take care of them. But we're stuck with it, and Madison, in fact, drafted the Seventh Amendment in about the vaguest way he possibly could. Even so, and the Seventh Amendment does mandate by its terms an originalist analysis. It says that the right shall be preserved at common law. And the common law under the Seventh Amendment is the common law of England in 1791. There were things that judges were doing in England in 1791 that we could also do, potentially. And one of them is, in complicated cases, the English judges would never let that go to an ordinary jury. What they did was they had special juries. So Lord Mansfield was no dummy. He had a lot of marine insurance cases. That was a huge economic issue in England at the time. And he knew that these had to be decided correctly. And what he did was he had a group of retired sea captains that he would call together and say, was what this ship captain did correct? And what does this mean for the insurance case? We could do that as well. We could have juries of experts, doctors in medical malpractice cases, engineers in various types of cases. In addition, in other sorts of cases, there were at common law very strict rules about joinder. You could not join many, many claims together. You could not join many, many parties together. The English judges thought you had to have these limitations because an ordinary jury could not handle those types of disputes. And so they had very strict rules about joinder. And we could go back to that, have strict rules about joining claims and parties. And if you have a case that is so limited, it can go to a jury. And if not, it has to go to a judge. And furthermore, we could have judge and agency, for that matter, adjudication done right. What does that mean? First of all, of course, an independent decision maker, an independent judiciary. Fortunately, we have that in the federal system. As you know, that is not always the case in the state systems. And that needs to be addressed. Judges can control discovery more than they do. There can be time limits for judges so that they will make decisions by a certain period of time. You can use panels of multiple judges, potentially, even to limit the bias that you can get with a single decision maker. And most importantly, in my view, full appeal. So I would prefer the standard of de novo review, fact and law, but if you can't do that, at least you would have a review of, with some deference of judicial findings of fact, and also, of course, de novo decisions of law. And I think if we went to a system like that, we could have a fairer and more efficient justice system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spector. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judge Porter, very much. And Professor Lerner, thank you for your provocative observations. In 1961, when President Kennedy went to France, he famously said that I am the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris, and I am the man who was invited to be present today by Louis Capozzi. Louis Capozzi has the finest chance of being a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court of any person I've ever known. I have taught at four American law schools over the past 20 years. He is by far the most outstanding student that I've taught. I prepared him for his interview with Justice Gorsuch so that he would be in a position to have the best chance possible to obtain a clerkship with His Honor, and I'm proud that Lewis was selected as a law clerk to Justice Gorsuch, and I'm very proud to be Lewis's friend and only too happy to have accepted his invitation to come here today. I did not feel concerned about a lack of time to prepare on this subject. I don't believe it's very complicated to prepare to defend the right to trial by jury. I see the benefits to getting rid of juries. I know that it would provide a tremendous amount of work for stonemasons and sandblasters, because we would have to blast mottos off of federal courthouses and state courthouses all across the country, extolling the benefits of the right to trial by jury. And perhaps we do need to provide those jobs to stonemasons and sandblasters. But I would ask us to consider the bad things that might occur if we were to go ahead and take that step. I'm reminded of Churchill's comment that democracy is the worst of all forms of government, except those others that have been tried from time to time. And I readily concede, Professor Lerner, that there are outlier determinations by jurors. I don't know anything about that dream, and that may have really happened, and that juror may have convinced his fellow jurors to accept an unreasonable result. That's possible. I do know a little bit about that $8 billion verdict that occurred a couple of blocks from here. I think it's dangerous to talk about cases where we weren't in the courtroom, but I don't have that problem because I was in that courtroom. And oh yes, of course there's a conventional wisdom that verdict will be cut, and we all know why that conventional wisdom might exist, but I was not surprised that there was a billion-dollar plus verdict against Johnson & Johnson. In that case, it was a subject that Tom Klein and I had discussed many times prior to that verdict concerning that litigation. Yes, the product had been approved by the FDA, including the label, but the FDA did not know what Johnson & Johnson knew, which was that there was a 12% rate of breasts being developed in males who were taking the pharmaceutical, because that fact was not told to doctors. It was not in the label. And that's why, in part, why the jury concluded that the extraordinarily strict burden of proof was met under Maryland punitive damages law. Anybody who knows Maryland substantive law on punitive damages knows how strict that law is. And of course, the trial judge is obligated to reduce that verdict if he believes that it shocks his conscience, and he is further obligated to apply a due process standard of review pursuant to the arc of U.S. Supreme Court cases from the latter part of the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century. And this room, I'm sure, knows that case law reasonably well. And of course, if the trial judge doesn't get it right, there is the Superior Court of Pennsylvania. And if they don't get it right, there is the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And if they don't get it right, there is the U.S. Supreme Court. So I don't think we have to fear the potential for wreck and ruin from a large verdict. I would also comment that while this is not the standard, I would ask you to think of it this way. If a person, and obviously a corporation should be treated like a person, if a person committed a malicious act that caused the kind of harm we're talking about here, and they were worth $600,000, not $60 billion, would we really draw a heavy breath if there were an award to punish of $80,000 as against a $600,000 net worth? I doubt that we would. And that's the exact ratio that occurred here. So notwithstanding all of the legal standards that protects the defendant in this case, as well they should be protected by those standards, again, I don't think we have to fear that a mass injustice is about to occur to Johnson & Johnson. I would say, I would make notes of points of agreement with Professor Lerner. I share her view, I think this is her view, that there are too few cases that are tried. I think that we lawyers undervalue the importance of a jury verdict. I'm a plaintiff's lawyer. And when I sit with my clients and the verdict is intoned, the mere intonation of the verdict has value and memory and salience to them that lives on for the rest of their lives. Yes, a finding of liability is very important. Yes, the amount of damages are very important. But the act of the intonation of the verdict that 12 members, or in federal court, six, of the community have expressed whether there was a wrong, a compensable wrong, and what the appropriate amount of compensation, and in rare cases, punishment should be, has enormous value. And I don't think we should underestimate the value to our communities of having those verdicts rendered. That Murray case, which is the name of that case involving J&J, could have been settled. I won't get into the details of that, but one could imagine. There is great value in having a public discussion about whether there was wrongful corporate conduct that affected tens of thousands of young men across America. And Johnson & Johnson has great other problems, as you well know. I don't have to detail those for you. A lot of those involve litigation. There is an important conversation to be had about whether that company, perhaps uniquely among American companies, has lost its way. It's not an accident that they have 103,000 lawsuits involving two dozen separate lines of products, Risperdal being only one of them. I've been very involved with the vaginal mesh litigation and trials here in Philadelphia, trials that have gone both ways, involving that product, with documents similar to the ones that were introduced in the Risperdal cases. This is an important conversation for us to have, and if we don't have jury verdicts, we have a much harder time having that conversation. We've had 10 such verdicts in the last 4 years in the vaginal mesh litigation. And yes, there are verdicts that are too small, but as I teach my law students in torts class, there are two things that begin with the letter A that has never existed. One of them is Atlantis, and the other of them is Aditur. There's no such thing as Atlantis, and there's no such thing as Aditur. Show me a case where there has been an increase in a verdict. That just does not happen. And so, yes, I do think that's an issue. I also think it's an issue in terms of whether a plaintiff can get a fair trial in a medical malpractice case in a suburban or rural venue. I don't mind telling you that Pennsylvania has 67 counties, and in 66 counties, I would waive my client's right to a trial by jury, because I believe it's very tough to convince a jury in a suburban or rural jurisdiction who, excuse me, like their doctors and their hospitals just fine, thank you. And if you want to get city care, go to the city. And I don't fear that with the judge. It's true. Yes, juries are more democratic. Yes, they are more representative of the community. Yes, a judicial panel is going to be more elite, less representative, less diverse. One person is less diverse than 12 or even 6. But yes, I that concerns me about what I see happening in medical malpractice cases. Over 90% of medical malpractice trials outside of Philadelphia County result in defense verdicts. 65% in Philadelphia County result in defense verdicts. So it's not that much better in Philadelphia. But notwithstanding the infirmities, I think that the jury trial is vastly more valuable to all of us in our communities. Because even though there's an occasional mistake, there are remedies that are available, as we've discussed. And finally, I'd like to say this. I read Professor Lerner's writings on this subject, and she proposes that we have panels of judges decide cases. 3 to 5 judges decide cases. I want to suggest to you how cumbersome that would be. I've been involved in 3-judge arbitrations. I'll bet there are people in this room who've also been involved in 3-judge arbitrations. How many years does it take you to get those 3-judge arbitration cases tried? You know, you come together for a day or two, and at the end of it, you get your calendars together, and you can't get 3 busy arbitrators with other important pressing matters in their lives and the parties in the case to agree on a date for a resumption of an arbitration in less than 6 to 9 months. We don't have that problem with juries. And I would also suggest to you that I sharply, sharply disagree with the proposition that we should have de novo review by appellate courts of trial judges' judgments on fact-finding. The trial judge is uniquely able to assess the credibility of the witnesses. You cannot assess that, respectfully, Your Honor, by looking at a cold transcript. And that's why appropriate deference is given. I'd be pleased to respond to questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, that was great.
Are you going to be? Okay. I have a couple of questions, but first I'd defer to any questions in the audience. Okay. I guess this one's probably directed first to Professor Letow. Other than going to the polling place on election day, jury service may be one of the few public acts of civic duty that most people get to perform. Does that kind of Republican argument carry any weight for you?
This was actually part of a major debate at the founding, as I believe you know. This was a major debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists about the nature of democratic participation. Both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists knew that they were establishing some form of democracy, Republican democracy. The Federalists wanted a large republic, and the democratic element in that large republic would be that the citizens could go to the polls and elect their representatives. That was the major form of democratic participation that they saw. The Anti-Federalists wanted smaller republics. So they wanted, some of them even thought that the states themselves were too big. They wanted smaller, more homogeneous groups of people. And the way that they envisioned their participation in government was not just through elections, but also through participation on juries. The Federalists did not view juries that way. So they thought that the main democratic participation would be popular elections. So this was a debate going back to the very founding of the country. And a difference between them, the Federalists, if you like, looked at juries sort of instrumentally and say, criminal juries are good because they help to prevent tyranny by the government. Civil juries are not so necessary.
That's a great distinction you just make. Is everyone agreed that with respect to the criminal trials, the jury remains an important sort of barrier between individuals and the state?
Or would you, or some of your arguments also?
Yeah, absolutely. I think lay participation is necessary in criminal cases in some form. We happen to have a separate criminal jury, but other countries now, even countries that traditionally did not use juries, are moving toward lay participation in criminal cases by using, for example, mixed panels, where you have, for instance, in France, 3 professional judges and 9 lay jurors. It can be done different ways.
If there are no questions, I'll ask another one. Oh, here, yeah.
My question is this: jury services, we all know, can involve a significant time commitment from jurors to take them away from their families and jobs for a long time. Is it fair to ask people to do that? Is it, you know, could it not be thought of as a form of involuntary servitude?
So this is from Matthew Hank, who is my former student, right here. Mr. Spector got to brag about his former student, and I now get to brag about Hank, Matt Hank. So thanks very much. Matt practices employment discrimination law. And we discussed this a little bit. Also sitting here, Alita Cass was just called for jury service in New Jersey, where the jury fee is $5 per day of Mrs. Cass's time. I think that it's safe to say that Alita Cass's time is more valuable than $5 a day. But that is what New Jersey sees fit to pay her for that service. This, again, is something that has troubled people in the American Republic for a long time. Going back to the 18th century and even in becoming increasingly important in the 19th century, back when we actually did hold jury trials, jurors had to show up. And it was hard for them. So farmers would be called during the harvest. This, most people thought, was okay if it was a criminal case, because there they could see the public interest. They could see the interest of the community in deciding that case with lay participation. But many people in the 19th century strongly objected to having to show up for civil cases. They said, look, why should I show up at a busy time for me during the harvest? And have to decide somebody's dispute about a debt, you know, between two private parties. They did not like that at all. And that is one of the reasons why in the 19th century we got rules about waiver of jury trial, for example. Juries of fewer than 12, majority verdicts, all of that started in the 19th century in civil cases for exactly this reason, that people didn't want to be burdened. And of course, then there's the perpetual problem of people shirking jury service, right? People just taking their summons and tossing it in the trash. I always ask just about everybody I know, you know, have you gotten a jury summons and what did you do with it? The most alarming responses I've had are from my law students who say, yeah, I just took the thing and I tossed it in the trash. I've got courses to go to, I've got exams to take, this kind of thing. So it is a great burden. It is not compensated. It would be very difficult to compensate. If we went back to a regime where we actually did hold more jury trials, that would be an increasingly large problem.
So I think we can agree that jurors are undercompensated for what they do, and they should be paid more for jury service. In Pennsylvania, jurors receive $7 a day for the first 3 days and then $25 thereafter per statute, which has been around for decades. And we can't get the legislature to raise that because defense interests believe correctly that if jury service weren't such an economic hardship, that folks who are poor wouldn't be able to say to judges, I can't sit, which is what they currently say. It's too much of a hardship. I live from check to check. I can't afford to live on $7 a day and then $25 if this case goes beyond 3 days. And defense interests don't want those folks on juries. And that's discouraging, to put it mildly. So I hope we could agree, whether we represent plaintiffs or defendants, that we want to have jurors who are diverse and people who are not deterred from jury service because of that horrific level of compensation. On the other hand, I would suggest to you that people who serve on juries say repetitively to me and many others, and I'll bet in this room, that serving on a jury was one of the highlights of their life, that they felt they did something important, that they felt that they made a contribution to the community. Chief Justice Earl Warren said that aside from putting on the uniform of your nation in time of war, the most important thing you can do for your country is to serve on a jury. It's more important than paying taxes or voting. I say that to every single juror in every single closing speech I give at the start of the speech, and I get knowing nods because they feel that they're doing something important in sitting there in that case. And I think we should feel good about that. I say to jurors in closing speech, I know it's customary for lawyers to thank jurors for their service. I don't think that you need thanks. I think you know how important it is what you're doing, and that it's an honor to sit on a jury in a case like this. So, you know, I think that's a great thing about the jury system. Last comment, and that is, respectfully, I sense a certain inconsistency in Professor Letal Lerner's views, because she supports a jury in criminal cases, but not in civil cases. Yet her principal objection to juries in civil cases is that jury trials is that they're long, expensive, and unpredictable. Well, you could make the same arguments with respect to criminal cases. Yet, and there's some merit to it, I suppose, but yet the support of juries in criminal cases seems inconsistent with their abolition. Maintenance of them in criminal cases seems inconsistent with their abolition for civil cases. Thank you.
I just wanted to say, along those lines, I do think there's a consistency there. I do think criminal cases involve more of the interest of the community. I do think that when you're talking about putting someone away for long periods of time, imprisoning someone, that there is lay judgment that should go into that, and our criminal laws should be understandable by lay people, and not have all of the complexity that our civil cases necessarily sometimes do. I do think there's a very intense community interest involved in criminal cases. And I would say that this feeling that jurors have, and I've heard this many times from people, that jurors feel after their service that they have done something significant. And that is true. And I think we need to concentrate that on criminal cases. That's where we need it most. So have them work on criminal cases. Civil cases, we can have other people decide. But in criminal cases, there is truly more of that element of the needs of the community. And we have limited resources. We don't have endless resources to have jury trials in every possible type of case. And given that we have limited resources, I think it makes sense to concentrate juries in criminal cases.
I'll ask a question and then the next one will be over there. This, both of you could address this, but I think in the first instance, I'm directing it to Mr. Spector. From an institutional perspective, unlike judicial decisions, jury verdicts don't announce and articulate a legal rule of decision. So you could have two identical sets of plaintiffs with basically identical fact patterns who obtain different outcomes depending upon the whims of a jury or the skill of an advocate. And without a legal rule, like a judge or a court would announce, it's nearly difficult for businesses or others to predict the legal consequences of their conduct. Even after the fact, the jury verdict is just a data point. It's not a legal rule that's announced and tailored the way an opinion does. Is that an important point when we consider arguments for or against juries?
Your Honor, I think that you've conflated a couple of concepts here, respectfully. I think that if a judge lets a case go to verdict or does not overturn a verdict, she's making a legal judgment. And that legal judgment has value for the community and for the parties in that case and for the parties and others like them in future cases. So we don't lose that by having a jury system. Yes, the jury doesn't explain exactly why they found the way they did, but they respond to jury interrogatories. In a product liability case, they tell us if the product was defective and if the defect caused harm. They tell us if there was a failure to warn and if that failure to warn caused harm. If the defendant was negligent, if that negligence caused harm. And parties can learn things from those answers. In the vaginal mesh litigation, for example, there have been 10 trials involving our firm. We've lost 2 and won 8, but we lost the 2 on causation. In all 10 cases, there was a finding of product defect. That says something very important to us and very important to Johnson & Johnson about future trials, doesn't it? So we learn very valuable things from having jurors. And the things we don't learn that are important, we still learn from the judges.
So, my name is Greg. I'm working over here. So, I understand the statistics that there's this vast decline in civil jury trials and a huge increase in settlements. And I understand that there's this like nice democratic feeling that a person might have from sitting on a jury. I've sat on a jury, and it's true, everything you said. I'm not sure, though, I understand really, what is the negative effect of not having more civil jury trials. Like, what's wrong with the vast majority of cases settled before trial? Why is that bad?
So, as I tried to explain, settlements are not often based entirely on the merits of the case, right? They are based on other things. They're based on guesses about what a jury might do, for example. So bargaining in the shadow of the jury. And that is true, for example, in my own case, I saw it very directly. I got a lower settlement in Northern Virginia than I would have got if I had had the accident, if the person had hit me in Washington, D.C. I would have gotten a higher settlement because of the juries. Mainly, in part because of the law, but mostly because of the jury. So that's an example. In addition, settlement negotiations has a lot to do with risk aversion, right? How risk, what kinds of risk is the party willing to take? Has a lot to do with that. And then, of course, it has a lot to do with the expected cost of litigation. And what will it take to make this thing go away? Because we don't shift fees in this country.
I guess I'm not seeing the negative of any of those things.
Well, you're living in the system, right? It's hard to see how it could be different. There are systems that adjudicate differently. So they exist, right? They're not mythical. There are legal systems out there that are not common law systems that do regularly adjudicate. They're not American systems. that do regularly adjudicate cases. England, by the way, and all of the other common law countries have essentially abolished the civil jury. They have kept juries in criminal cases, but they have essentially abolished the civil jury. We're the only ones left that are, excuse me, crazy enough to do this thing. Okay. So an English judge, a German judge, a French judge, a Canadian judge, right? It's done differently. They are the fact finders. And they manage discovery, much more to the extent that there is. There's much less discovery in England, of course, much more actively than most judges do here. And when they say to a party, you know what, or the parties, you know what, it's looking like I'm going to fine for the plaintiff, and it's looking like I might find $1.5 million in damages, would you like to settle? That's valuable information, right? In that case, the settlement will more accurately reflect the merits of the case. And plus, the rest of the world has fee shifting and cost shifting in civil litigation. So loser pays. So those are additional ways. And the same thing happens in the German court. So if a judge tells you what he or she is likely to do, that's likely to happen, and you might want to get together and settle to save some costs. On the other hand, you know, the thing goes to judgment, and there you go. So there are higher rates of going to judgment, even in those systems, than there is in ours. But even where they settle, the settlements more accurately reflect the merits of the case.
We have about 4 minutes.
So I thought it was very interesting the discussion of the distinction between criminal and civil juries, and I wonder if an additional element that might support sort of valuing one more strongly than the other is the capacity for the jurors to make sort of decisions that are at issue in a criminal case as opposed to a civil case. And I'm thinking specifically about the capacity to sort of evaluate more simple facts of did a thing happen, as opposed to evaluating expert testimony and things that require sort of higher level thinking that you may not sort of, what's sort of the value added of bringing in sort of a cross-section of the community to evaluate experts?
So I think regrettably, we're underemphasizing the potential complexities of criminal trials and the potential simplicity of some civil trials. Some criminal trials involve complicated scientific evidence, including DNA and the like, and we test the outer limits of all of our capacities, including judges and including lawyers, expert witnesses, jurors, everyone, to understand exactly what's being said. But that's true equally across the board. I wanted to comment very briefly, Judge Porter, on your comment about inconsistent results with different parties and the like. You know, that's a fact of life for all of us, isn't it? One of us may get a great second grade teacher, one of us may get a poor second grade teacher. One of us may have a great lawyer, somebody else may have a poor lawyer. There's a certain amount of arbitrariness across the board in the human experience. It doesn't mean that our justice system is going to be improved by getting rid of juries.
Last question.
I think following up on your remark, the very decline in jury trials leads to inexperienced lawyers who aren't ready to go to trial, haven't tried enough cases, haven't prepared themselves to be a threat because they're known as lawyers who don't go to court, they're known as lawyers who settle. And I think it's a philosophical problem of major proportions as to having an appropriate proportion or availability of our profession who actually doesn't do a sloppy job, bad preparation, running around in circles when they're trying to put exhibits on, and there's embarrassing circumstances that ought to embarrass the profession. It's a philosophical problem of big proportions.
I think this is one of the areas where Mr. Spector and I agree that there should be more adjudication. Right? I think that's fair to say. Yep. I think we both think that there should be more adjudication.
Yes.
More going to final judgment. Now, the question about juries, is it important that lawyers understand how to do a jury trial for the profession? That's an interesting question. Is jury trial for the profession? Is that why we do it? Is it for the legal profession? This is a question worth asking. The founders, all of them, including I think the anti-federalists, would not have said that it was for the profession.
But I think that the greater risk is lazy lawyers.
Right, that more cases should go to adjudication. Yeah.
This has been a terrific discussion. Please thank our panelists.